Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. In recent weeks, large industrial meatpacking plants across the country have emerged as one of the epicenters of the COVID-19 outbreak. We have done several shows about this. According to the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, more than 170 meat and poultry processing plants nationwide have reported COVID-19 outbreaks. A new investigation by the Food and Environment Reporting Network, in collaboration with Mother Jones, tells the stories of the industry's failure to protect tens of thousands of low-wage, mostly immigrant workers. Based on extensive interviews, the piece looks at the plight of workers at a JBS meat processing plant in Greeley, Colorado, the epicenter of the state's COVID outbreak. In the piece, union president Kim Cordova says it is not safe for meat packers to return to work. She told ABC in Denver, quote, "I think the workers are being sacrificed. I think this could potentially be a death sentence," end quote. According to data collected by the Food and Environment Reporting Network, as of May 8th, there have been 48 deaths due to COVID-19 at meatpacking plants in the United States. Close to 15% have occurred at JBS in Greeley, Colorado. JBS is the largest meat producer in the world and one of the biggest in the United States. The company employs more than 60,000 people across the country, slaughters 13 million animals every day, and has revenues of $50 billion. That's every year. Joining us to talk about this piece and the plight of meat processing workers are two guests. Ted Genoways is an award-winning journalist. He's a contributing writer at Mother Jones and The New Republic and author of This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. Hi, Ted. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rose. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you so much. We're also joined by Esther Honig, an award-winning journalist who has built her career working as a reporter for NPR member stations in Colorado, Ohio, and Missouri. Esther focuses on agriculture, the impacts of climate change, and immigration. Hi, Esther. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for having me.
Hi, great. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. Thank you for this very important, in-depth piece that really does focus on the workers. Before we dive in, Ted, can you give us an update? Last week, we talked about the executive order that came from the federal government to basically open meat plants across the country. Can you give us an update? Do you have any idea how many plants decided to open because of that order?
Well, obviously the situation is changing, you know, almost by the hour. What I can tell you is that one of the sort of stunning things to me, just looking at, it's been exactly 10 days since Esther and I published this story on the Mother Jones website. In that time, the number of workers nationwide who have positive tests for COVID-19 has doubled. The number of workers who have died has doubled. The number of meatpacking plants that are affected has doubled. But what has gone down is the number of plants that are closed in order to allow for cleaning and for self-quarantining to try to stop that spread. And so while we reported that there were 20 plants closed just 10 days ago, that number has gone down, that there are currently only three meatpacking plants nationwide that are closed. I think a lot of that can be directly attributed to the executive order instructing them to stay open. But the reality is going to be, as time progresses here, that you're not going to be able to keep a plant open if you don't have workers on the line to process the animals as they go through.
Let's also just quickly talk about the power of this industry. Esther, the New York Times ran a piece recently called Powerful Meat Industry Holds More Sway After Trump's Order. And according to the story, the executive action was followed by weeks of lobbying behind the scenes and in public by meat companies led by Tyson, a beef, pork, and processor that generates $40 billion in annual revenue. The Times reports that these companies have exerted a lot of power on Republican and Democratic administrations, adding to the industry. You also have the huge ag slaughterhouses that have also put pressure on. So let's talk about the power of these industries, especially when it comes to this administration.
Well, you know, I can speak definitely to the power of these companies on a local level. In places like Greeley, they're the largest employer in the town, and so they have a large sway over local politics. And those are the folks who are making decisions over reopening their local economy or ensuring, you know, in the case of Greeley, that it was local health, it was from the local health department and the state health department that initially asked the plant to close. And so, you know, these local actors are incredibly important when it comes to checking in on these plants and seeing what conditions are like for workers or being able to pressure the plant and demanding that they close. But when they have so much sway in local politics because of their economic impact, we've also seen that they get to, for example, in Greeley, they were ordered to test all of their employees before reopening, and they simply just didn't do it. I think because they didn't want to disclose truly how many workers had become sick with COVID-19. So you see these plants really being able to hold sway over how they operate. And in a lot of, for instance, in Nebraska, you know, Governor Ricketts has decided that they're not going to share the number of cases of COVID-19 from these plants any longer. And that, you know, if you have, and he's also, you know, pressuring these plants to stay open, that local health officials cannot ask that they be closed. So, you know, this has a real impact on a local level, just from local governments. These plants hold a huge sway.
Right. Ted, what would you add about the sway that the plants hold, and then also the slaughterhouses and the farmers? Because according to the Times, the farmers who expected that they would have to euthanize 150,000 pigs every day also pushed for federal intervention.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think one of the clearest indications of the sway at the federal level is to look at the sort of roundtable summit that was hosted by Mike Pence in Des Moines on Friday. At that meeting were CEOs from Smithfield and from Tyson and from Mount Air Farms, some of the largest meat packers in the country. There were also CEOs from Kroger and from Hy-Vee, big grocery chains. The head of the American Farm Bureau was there, but there was nobody present to represent the interests of the meatpacking workers. No one present to represent the interests of small farmers. And so what really does seem to be happening is exactly what you described, that these companies are extremely powerful, they hold huge sway, and in a moment where there's a crisis, they step forward and say, we're the only ones who can, who have the size and the scale to address these problems, so you have to deal with us exclusively. And what ends up happening is that the small producers get squeezed out. To your point about the losses and the destruction of animals and the dumping of dairy, a lot of this is just the result of the bottlenecks that have been built into this system by having such intense concentration. When you describe JBS and its incredible global reach and you know, $50 billion in sales and millions of animals processed every day, and you've got a company that is the largest beef processor in America, it's doing all of that in 9 packing plants. And so when it ends up with a situation like the one it's in now, where 2/3 of its plants have a major outbreak and there's a reduction in the workforce and there's a reduction in the ability to process that beef, then there's a real problem for consumers and farmers both, because everything has to pass through those packing houses. And so what you end up with is a situation where you've got farmers who have cattle that they're desperate to bring to market so that they can get paid, and at the same time, you've got Wendy's announcing that they don't have beef for hamburgers. And that's all the result of a narrow bottleneck And that massive control that's exerted by being in charge of that bottleneck.
And we should also point out that this executive order does not mandate the plants stay open, but it signals that the decisions around whether to close or reopen should be driven by the federal government, not local authorities. And this is according to the Times. Esther, can you talk about why this is so important?
Well, you know, I think the emphasis has really been placed on the meat supply. You know, we've deemed workers essential, perhaps enough value in our society to give them those protections that would make the protections also mandatory. In that executive order, there were guidelines issued by the CDC for meatpacking plants, but those are still optional. So while we're, you know, insisting that these plants continue operating, we haven't made those protections for workers mandatory. So it's fairly alarming.
Can you both talk about what it is like to report on these massive meat processing plants, like JBS, for example? You point out in your Mother Jones piece that, you know, local media are doing a really good job around this. In fact, a lot of the first reporting came from local media because either people who worked at the plant or their relatives sent tips to local media. But as you report, local media have dwindling resources and few reporters who speak Spanish. And this has really created a culture of silence around these plants. Can you talk about that first, Ted?
Yeah, well, this has been a long-standing problem, that sort of cultural and language barrier, and as Esther can attest also from her reporting over the years, this has only become a bigger challenge for news agencies as the industry has turned to other workforces, and as a way of keeping that workforce fractured and unlikely to organize. So now it's not uncommon to have a single meatpacking plant where there may be 30 different languages spoken. And not only does that pose real problems when you get into a health emergency for just trying to get out information that is accurate and is properly translated to get to each of those communities, but if you're trying to report on the impact of this health emergency on all of those different communities, it's an incredibly challenging problem, and it's a language barrier, it's a cultural barrier, and what does end up happening is that that many people who work in the factories, who work in these plants, feel like their interests just aren't being represented, aren't being heard, and so they have a tendency not to speak up and to speak out. What I think is fascinating about what's happening right now is that after decades of conditions being so taxing and dangerous, and accepting that as sort of the baseline for doing this kind of work, layering on this incredible risk of and risk to life, really, of this virus, not only are the workers speaking up, but maybe more importantly, their kids, many of whom are native English speakers, are speaking up on their behalf, and they're reaching out to news agencies, and they are sharing those stories directly. They're offering to serve as interpreters. They're organizing. There's an organization, a group that's kind of popped up spontaneously called the Children of Smithfield, and this is becoming, I think, a really important force in telling this story. And it will be interesting to see if they're able to not only improve conditions through this crisis, but if they're able to affect long-term change to improve conditions for their parents and for future meatpackers.
We actually had a daughter, Veronica, the daughter of a meat processing plant worker, on our show last week. Her mom tested for COVID. Luckily, she's doing okay. But that has been fascinating to watch, Ted. A number of Smithfield children were also protesting in South Dakota last week. What would you add, Esther, given that you've done a lot of reporting on this, just about the difficulties of reporting about what's happening in the plants and then speaking with the workers?
Well, in my experience, you know, I've been long drawn to reporting on the communities that live in these towns, the workers in these plants, the conditions in these plants, and I will say that it is often very, very difficult to get someone to talk to you, even anonymously, because there is so much fear about backlash. And just to give you, there was actually a child of a plant worker that I, or an adult child of a plant worker that I spoke to just last week, and they gave me a really great, I felt like, an anecdotal example of why so many folks might be so worried or so fearful of speaking out and potentially losing their job. And that was that they said, you know, if they lose this job, say, for example, in Greeley, Colorado, they have to relocate to the next meatpacking plant town. So if this is where they found that they can make a good wage to support their family, this is the work that they think fits best with their skill set. Maybe they're not a fluent English speaker. Perhaps they don't have a secondary education. This is their livelihood. And if they lose this job, say at JBS or Tyson, they have to relocate to another town to find that job again. And so that's why folks, I feel, are so pressed. They feel so much pressure and so much fear about retaliation from their employer. There are unions in some plants. There aren't unions in other plants. We're seeing a lot of the protests that you mentioned in Nebraska. There's been more in the Crete plant because there's a union representing workers there. That's one theory, and perhaps fewer workers are willing to speak out at other plants because they don't have those same protections.
And as you both report, Esther, an estimated quarter of meatpacking workers in the U.S. are undocumented, and so they are definitely afraid to speak out.
Right.
There have been stories about people from, you know, Sudan ending up in South Dakota working at these meat processing plants. Esther, how do these immigrants end up in places like Greeley, Colorado, or Nebraska, or South Dakota to work at these meat processing plants?
There are a number of different ways. It might be secondary migration. So someone might be resettled in a popular resettlement site, say Minnesota or Denver, Colorado, and then they might, within their community, perhaps the people from their same country, they might hear that there's people, say, from South Sudan like them working in Greeley, Colorado, and there's this job at this meatpacking plant. So they might relocate to go there and find that job. There are other instances, like Greeley, that has actually been deemed a secondary relocation site. And that has a lot to do with JBS being there. So JBS works with state officials to make that a secondary relocation site because they are so willing to employ people who may have few employable skills. Say, again, they maybe grew up in a refugee camp and weren't able to obtain a secondary education, or they can't read or write, or they don't have English-speaking skills. You know, all of these things really are barriers for folks to be able to access better jobs. And so JBS and these meatpacking plants really present themselves as some of the most accessible work for folks in these coming from, you know, some of these conditions abroad, refugee camps and conflict zones and whatnot. And so some of these folks, again, might choose to relocate there to be with these jobs, or they might in fact be directly sent from the refugee camp to Greeley, Colorado, to work at that plant. And that's part of their resettlement process, is that job that will make them economically independent as soon as possible.
Ted, I'm guessing that a lot of people have not heard about JBS or don't really know much about it, especially before the COVID crisis. We're going to do a show about these various meat processing plants in the coming weeks. But just quickly, this is a Brazilian-owned multinational that brings in $50 billion annually as the world's largest meat processor. According to the piece you both wrote for Mother Jones, at this plant in Greeley, the plant employees are processing about 5,000 cows a day. What else do we need to know about this JBS plant?
Well, I suppose the thing that is worth knowing even before we look at the plants in particular, the JBS as a company, as you mentioned, is Brazilian-owned. They are a company that has had a lot of problems legally in the United States and in Brazil. Most notably, they were involved in a corruption scandal in Brazil, where they, as part of their settlement agreement, admitted to bribing close to 1,200 government officials as part of how they ordinarily do business. So this is a very large multinational company that also has, I would say, a very spotty track record when it comes to following and observing the rules that are imposed by the government, whether that's in Brazil, in the United States, or around the world. As part of that, as this pandemic has become centered more and more in the meatpacking plants, obviously, as we would expect, there's been kind of an uneven response. Some companies have seemed to move faster, and their outbreaks have been relatively limited, while other companies like JBS and Tyson have become real centers of the outbreaks. And in the case of JBS, I think it would be hard to deny that part of what's going on there is that there seems to be a company-wide resistance to testing and contact tracing their employees. We talked about that in Colorado and Nebraska. Since then, there's been reporting on similar issues in their plants in Minnesota and Wisconsin. It really seems to be a company-wide decision that if there aren't hard numbers on the number of workers who are infected and the number of workers who are out sick and potentially quite ill and have been hospitalized, then there will be less information available to bring pressure to bear on the company to respond accordingly. As Esther mentioned earlier, I think the thing that's really disturbing is to see that mentality then starting to spread to the state-level governments as they're making their decisions about reopening. Here in Nebraska, Governor Pete Ricketts has been adamant that it should be up to the packing plants themselves to decide whether or not to close down. And as Esther also mentioned, you know, just last week, at a point when we were all expecting to get hard numbers on some particular meatpacking plants and their impact, particularly the Tyson plant in Dakota City, Nebraska, the governor at his daily press conference announced that they would not be releasing specific data on individual plants, that henceforth they would only give numbers on meatpackers as a class. And so we know that the numbers of infected meatpackers is continuing to climb, but we're now going to have to try to guess at some of the places where those outbreaks are taking place based on county data of overall spread.
We're going to take a quick break, and after a break, we'll continue talking about what happens when there's no federal mandate when it comes to the protection of workers. That is Ted Genoways, an award-winning journalist, contributing writer at Mother Jones and the New Republic. Esther Honig is an award-winning journalist who's built her career working as a reporter for NPR member stations in Colorado, Ohio, and Missouri. And I hope you can take the time to read the piece that Ted and Esther wrote for Mother Jones. It's called "The Workers Are Being Sacrificed as Cases Mounted, Meatpacker JBS Kept People on Crowded Factory Floors." And you can find it at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss the rise of COVID-related attacks against Asian Americans. Activists are organizing against the expectation that discrimination and violence will escalate after shelter-in-place orders are lifted. So we hope you can join us for that tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're continuing our coverage of COVID outbreaks in meat processing plants across the country. We're discussing a Mother Jones investigation about an outbreak at a JBS plant in Greeley, Colorado. JBS is the largest meat producer in the world, one of the biggest in the United States. And we're joined today by the authors of that Mother Jones piece. Ted Genoways is an award-winning journalist. He's the author of This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. Esther Honig is an award-winning journalist who has built her career working as a reporter for NPR stations in Colorado, Ohio, and Missouri. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Given that there is so much coverage now about COVID outbreaks in meat processing plants, what questions do you have? How does this affect your views about the meat industry and how these workers are treated? You can give us a call or email yourcall@kalw.org. Esther, I wanted to ask you about the testing, the information that we don't have. In your piece, you point out that the recent guidelines from the CDC and OSHA are voluntary, and you report right. that without federal mandates, the protection of these workers is uneven at best, and in some plants, adjustments to prevent the virus's spread have been virtually non-existent. So talk mm-hmm. a little bit more about that.
Well, there have been a lot of reports of, you know, plants saying that, well, we know that we're supposed to distribute face masks, but we don't have access to them, or, you know, there was a lag, like there were for, you know, many industries, even healthcare workers, in getting a hold of some of these supplies. So, you know, there is in part that concern, but, you know, generally what we've seen is just a lag on the part of employers to react. When they knew they had positive cases in their plants, to say, okay, we need to implement, we need to give people face masks, we need to make sure that there's hand sanitizer, we need to stagger lunch breaks, you know, do really as much as you can to keep workers safe, even though, you know, there are thousands of workers inside these plants working, you know, elbow to elbow. It is a very tough environment, I think, to try and control when it comes to a pandemic. But as long as there's nothing being federally mandated, you're still leaving it up to these employers to kind of figure it out as they go. We also reported on these dividers that have been set up between workers on the processing line. And in some cases, you know, these are kind of just sheets of plastic or sneeze guards. And there's really not a whole lot of evidence that these are going to be especially effective at keeping workers safe if you're still trying to operate a plant at 100% capacity. And that's been, you know, an increasing concern because, like, you know, we mentioned the executive order is really pushing to keep the food supply, the food chain going, and these plants are this crucial link in the chain. But if you are also trying to accommodate sick workers and keep people who are sick from coming to work, you're naturally going to have to, you know, decrease the output. But that's just not something that we've seen plants are really, they're not being encouraged to do it by the administration, you know, cutting back on their production, and it's not something that they want to do. And so you're still seeing workers working in the same conditions because there's the pressure to produce, even if you have fewer workers because more people are out sick, or even though they are in situations that are not going to be protective against preventing the spread of COVID-19.
So that's what's happening at the federal level. Ted, what about the state and local level? Because in your piece, you report that a team of local epidemiologists from the Weld County Department of Public Health and Environment in Colorado has interviewed employees in private. They were collecting data from local healthcare providers. So, what power do the local and state officials have on this?
Well, this is one of the, I think, one of the most kind of interesting battlegrounds that's emerging right now, because the local health departments do have purview, and they have some visibility into these plants by by being able to go and employ or interview the employees and going to inspect the way that the lines are set up and recommend changes to the workflow and to the way that the workers are protected. The problem that they face is that when they then make recommendations on what should happen, that really that the enforcement of those orders depends on being backed up by state level entities. And so, for example, you see that as a parallel circumstance, the Central Health Department in Nebraska that oversees where the JBS plant is in Grand Island, Nebraska, they looked at the number of cases, looked at the growth rate on the curve, and recommended to the governor of the state that he issue a closure order for the JBS plant. And that recommendation was made, we now know from a report from ProPublica, on March 26th, and the governor declined. The plant has still never been closed. And it appears that those cases are starting to flatten now, and but it's coming weeks later and after a considerable amount of spread around Hall County that has made it so that Grand Island, for a period of weeks, has been in the top five municipalities in the whole country for the speed and growth rate of the spread of the virus. And so even when health officials are recognizing the threat and informing the companies of that threat, if there's not somebody there from the state and federal level to say, we're going to enforce these instructions, these orders, then unfortunately they end up being really quite toothless.
Esther, it was shocking to read in the piece that one worker interviewed by Nebraska Appleseed, this is an organization, reported that supervisors at the Grand Island plant, quote, are telling people that even if they are positive, they can go to work, to keep it on the down low and to not say anything or they will get fired, end quote. And then you also say that JBS disputes this claim.
Yeah, and you see reporting now coming out from, you know, various meatpacking plants, not just JBS. I've read through Tyson and Cargill, you know, very similar accounts by workers that they were told, you know, even if they were feeling sick or had symptoms of COVID-19, to still come to work. And this, I think, has a lot to do with the pressure that these supervisors or employees feel, again, to continue that production level that they don't want to fall behind on. And so letting a worker go means perhaps letting that production number fall. And so, you know, this was an industry that already struggled with a labor shortage, that there wasn't a reserve of workers to fill in for sick workers. And so I think that, you know, in Colorado, really, the health department reported there was an issue of what healthcare practitioners were saying of their patients, these JBS workers were reporting that there was a culture of work while sick. And, you know, that's from, you know, my reporting, not necessarily something new during the pandemic. These workers have often had to come to work sick because they don't get paid sick leave, because if they miss so many shifts, they'll lose their job, because they'll get points docked towards their record, which could lead to more serious consequences for them. You know, this is an industry that often promotes people coming to work even if they have a cold, and getting their other workers around them sick. So when it came to a pandemic of a potentially deadly virus, the same culture was in place and perpetuated the sort of behavior.
Let's talk about one of the families you focus on in your piece, the Rodriguez family. Sergio Rodriguez has worked at the JBS factory in Greeley, Colorado for 40 years. He started when he was just 18 after he arrived in the United States from Durango, Mexico. His daughter, Crystal, has also worked at the factory. And Crystal said that when she was growing up, she remembers her dad would tell her and her siblings to stay in school because he did not want them to work at JBS. He would tell them, quote, they treat you like you're nothing, like you're an animal. Ted, tell us a little bit more about this family. And unfortunately, Sergio Rodriguez did get infected with COVID-19.
I'll let Esther talk a little bit more about the specifics of the family, because she's really been the point of contact with the family. But I do just want to say, picking up on what Esther said before, that unfortunately this is the sort of thing that I think we've both heard out of meatpacking workers for years. I've had I don't know how many workers say to me that they feel like they're treated like trash, like animals, like they're disposable. And it's only in this moment when that already strained situation gets pushed kind of over the edge and makes it so that the plants are not able to keep up with production. And we start to see the impact of that at the grocery store and at the fast food drive-through, that we pay attention. And unfortunately, this is something that isn't new. And yes, a family like the Rodriguez family, I mean, this is something that they've been dealing with for 40 years.
Esther, what can you tell us about the Rodriguez family?
I think that they're very typical of a large part of the community in Greeley. This, you know, JBS is the largest employer. It's a big deal in that part of the state, and there are many families like the Rodriguez where they're, you know, the kids were raised off of wages from the JBS plant, and by all means that was seen as a good employer. That's a steady wage, though, you know, it does often lead to sort of a lifestyle of living paycheck to paycheck, which again puts these workers in the position where they have to choose whether they're going to go to work or whether they're going to stay home because they're sick. And I think that for Crystal, it was, you know, she'd always looked up to her dad. He was always an incredibly hard worker. He'd come home from his shift at the end of the day exhausted, but still there to be a good dad. And when she became mom at a young age, she also looked towards JBS as a way to raise her young family, because it offered, the wages that were enough to get by in that part of the country.
And she said, all these years that my dad has given them, this is how they're going to show they care. I want to ask you both about, you know, what it will take to change this, because we've done so many shows about these meat packing companies and the slaughterhouses and this industry. We have an email from Carla, and she says, listening to this broadcast, the issue of workers who are not native speakers without a voice in their situation resembles what I recall when reading the book The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. Yeah. It's another horrifying example of how we've been sliding backwards as a democracy, the weakening of unionization, and the protections that are provided to workers and their families on so many levels. This is just dismal, she writes. What are your thoughts about this, Esther, just in terms of, I mean, just on a very basic level, basic dignity, ensuring that workers can get tested and have protective gear so they don't think that when they go to work, they might get COVID?
You know, the job, working in meatpacking plants, you know, as Upton Sinclair's reporting from the turn of the century shows, this has long been a job that was relegated to those with the fewest options in our society. You know, it's one of the least desirable jobs. And, you know, Ted in his work has highlighted moments in this industry was in fact a middle class job where the wages were excellent and there was unions and protections for workers. And that has all changed very much, I would say maybe Ted, the last 30 years or so, to where we're again in a place where workers are, I would say, you know, given perhaps being exposable to an extent, you know, that these plants knew that there was outbreaks, that they knew their workers were, you know, very likely to get sick, but yet giving them, it wasn't worth it, you know, to give them the paid sick leave or to allow them to quarantine without fear of losing their job.
Ted, what would you add? I mean, we're talking about $1 billion multinational corporations here.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is, I mean, one of the things that's fascinating in bringing up the case of The Jungle, before JBS became JBS, it was Swift and Company. It was purchased, bought out by JBS in 2007. Swift and Company is, in fact, the main packing house in Chicago. that Upton Sinclair went to in the early 1900s. So it's not just a parallel situation. It's in fact the same company. And so I think it's telling that these conditions have persisted this long, in part because we as consumers are willing to tolerate it. We, accept as a trade-off that there's a whole class of people who are usually new arrivals to our country who are going to be mistreated and do one of the most dangerous jobs that our country has to offer in order for us to have inexpensive food. The thing that I think is interesting about The Jungle as an example is that Sinclair wrote that book with the intention of calling attention to the plight of workers. What people latched onto and made the book a bestseller was the fact that there were all sorts of details about how there was, tubercular beef and spoiled meat that was being ground into sausage. And Sinclair, late in life, sort of famously said, "I aimed at the public's heart, but by accident hit it in the stomach." Mm-hmm. I think that we're in a similar situation. I would love to believe that the American public will move at this moment because we are suddenly seeing how important immigrant labor, refugee labor, undocumented labor is to making sure that we as a nation stay fed. But my suspicion is that what will motivate us is not the part of that equation where we're looking at their work conditions, but instead, as we look at the fact that the system, as it's been set up, is so centralized and the supply lines are so long that it's really brittle, it's really fragile, and that if we want to protect the national food supply, it's actually in our interest to also protect the workers. And so maybe it's always necessary to come from a position of self-interest when trying to win converts. In this case, I think that those interests are aligned, that the only way that our food supply is really going to become durable and decentralized in a way that makes it durable is to make meatpacking work into something that is a more humane job and a more sustaining job for the workers who perform those tasks.
Esther, what would you add? I've been thinking about this a lot. When we do a lot of shows about workers' rights, labor rights, movements, and you've got the teacher strikes, you have the Fight for 15. I mean, so many movements are happening around workers, but I rarely hear, on the progressive side, for example, I rarely hear much discussion about meat processing plant workers. And I'm trying to figure out why that is. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that it's definitely an aspect of our food supply that's in the shadows. I don't think that it's something that we consider very much anymore. The question of where our food comes from, I think, has been more and more of a concern. But still, when you buy a packet of ground beef at the grocery store, it's not going to say JBS on it. These are companies that people don't necessarily think about. And in my experience writing about meatpacking, I always have to kind of break that down. What does that mean? What do these jobs mean? Because these companies have become very closed off. They don't want reporters in there, so we're not allowed to, share the work of what a meatpacking plant often does from the inside. These places are very heavily guarded. And I think that's part of it, that this is just sort of a link in the supply chain that we're just not very cognizant of because we just haven't had the opportunity to see it very much, in our media or in our culture.
I think this is a great point, Esther. I know that when people buy chicken, I believe this is right, the Tyson label is on it. But do people see even the term JBS if they buy ground beef at the store, for example? I don't know. Ted, do you know?
Yeah, it's not a name that you're going to see. Most of what they're doing is supplying. So it's either going to be the label of the grocery store that is packaging it individually at retail, or most of it is going into the restaurant channel, which means mm-hmm. that it's being ground up into hamburger and is being supplied to fast food chains.
What else can you tell us about the supply chain? Because things have become so globalized. Demand for meat in other countries is on the rise in many cases. Yeah. So how can people know where their meat, bacon, pork, chicken is really coming from? Esther?
I think that's probably a better question for Ted. He is much more the expert in that area.
Okay, Ted?
I'm only chuckling because I have spent way too much time thinking about exactly this problem. The only solution that I can recommend is to know for now where your meat is actually coming from. And, you know, it doesn't come from a grocery store. It doesn't come from a fast food restaurant or even a high-end restaurant. It's coming from a farm. And if you don't know what the source of that meat is, you don't know really anything about the supply chain along the way. I think if anything, what I would hope out of all of this is that we would recognize that having a system that's too centralized means that the whole food supply is at risk, and that would create some impetus for having smaller packing houses, for having some regulatory changes that would allow the existing small packing facilities to be able to have more flexibility with where they ship to and which customers they serve. I've been hearing from small packers, I mean people who may process 10 animals in a week, that there's suddenly interest and demand both from consumers and from farmers and ranchers that would allow them to increase that output tenfold easily, but that there are regulatory hurdles. And so if we can make it so that there are some of those problems are addressed, that will improve the issue. But the problem that always exists with these sorts of issues is that when we try to address these problems from sort of the consumer side of things, at best what we do is create new niche markets that are available to people who have the money to spend on high-priced food. And so what we really need is people who are in national leadership who are willing to take the steps that are necessary to reform the food system. This seems to me a unique opportunity that we're in right now. There's a large national election about to happen that will determine the composition not only of the White House but of both houses of Congress, and it's a moment where the national attention is actually focused on this issue. The question then is whether this becomes a high enough priority for voters that it's something that drives their vote, and then when the election is decided, if it's something that they press leadership on to make those changes. It's not going to be easy because there's a lot of corporate money and influence that's expended on keeping things exactly the way they are. But But now, more than any time that I can remember, there's actually a moment where I think that the public attention is there and that there's some understanding that, that this is potentially a crisis if we don't do something different.
Right. Well, Senators Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker are joining forces on a bill to ban most factory farms by the year 2040, which is a ways away. Bringing it back to the workers, Esther, you know, the question is, if these changes do happen, how will they trickle down and affect workers like, you know, the people that you focused on, like the Rodriguez family, for example? And we have about a minute left.
You know, I just think that this pandemic has really highlighted that our country is lacking very simple protections for workers, things like paid sick leave, things that would have helped to prevent this in the first place, or stronger worker protections perhaps through unions, that there was some sort of someone not directly of the company looking in to see what conditions were like for workers in under these circumstances. So not allowing the companies to simply regulate themselves or decide what was safe enough for workers, because that's really where we are, that companies are deciding what is safe enough in order to continue production levels that they want to see from their plants.
Well, thank you both so much for writing this important piece. I hope you can take the time to read the Mother Jones piece, "The Workers Are Being Sacrificed as Cases Mounted, Meatpacker JBS Kept People on Crowded Factory Floors." Esther Honig is an award-winning journalist who has built her career working as a reporter for NPR stations in Colorado, Ohio, and Missouri. Esther, thank you for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ted Genoways is an award-winning journalist, contributing writer at Mother Jones, and author of This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. Ted, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
So great to be here. Thanks for covering this issue.
Thank you. And in the coming weeks, we will continue covering this issue. We are going to do specific shows about JBS, Tyson, Cargill, and Smithfield. And if you have any other ideas around this issue, we'd love to hear from you. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss the rise of COVID-related attacks against Asian Americans. From March 19th to April 30th, there were over 1,700 incidents of harassment and physical assault directed at Asian Americans, according to Stop AAPI Hate. Activists are organizing against the expectation that discrimination and violence could escalate after shelter-in-place orders are lifted. We hope you can join us for that show tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio going. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.